This audio recording is presented by Jews for Judaism. We are dedicated to keeping Jews Jewish. www.jewsforjudaism.ca.
Quite often on talk radio shows, when Hebrew Christians call up and ask either the rabbi on the panel or someone else, they ask certain questions. One of the questions they ask goes like this: what's so wrong with following the Jewish Messiah? And their question really, first of all, there's a certain assumption there, whether he's the Messiah or not. Second of all, is whether he's the Jewish Messiah. So the way they're phrasing the question, it's really a setup. How can you answer? It's not good. There's nothing wrong with following the Jewish Messiah, if he is the Messiah. But what if he's not the Messiah? Well, we've already demonstrated that earlier, that he's not. So I thought about this when I heard this question asked. And I started thinking, and I said, well, what would be the sin? What would be the transgression if someone followed someone as their Messiah and he wasn't really the Messiah? What would really be the transgression? Would it be that serious? And then I thought it would really depend how they defined the Messiah. If the Messiah was just a redeemer, that they believed that he was the redeemer who was meant to bring back the Jews, maybe it's not as serious an issue. So that we have to define, what are they thinking about when they say the Jewish Messiah? In fact, that's not really the issue. Because we have found throughout our history many times when there were many Jews that followed individuals who claimed to be the Messiah or were thought of to be the Messiah. And these people that followed this so-called Messiah weren't just ostracized and excommunicated from the Jewish community. The classic example we find, and you can look in one of your past handouts about the Messiah, was when Rabbi Akiva and all of the sages believed that Bar Kokhba was the Messiah. They said he was the Messiah. What is Maimonides writes? Right? He writes, not just Rabbi Akiva believed this, but all the rabbis at that time thought that he was the Messiah. All those rabbis weren't excommunicated for believing in a false Messiah. Why is that? Because the minute they realized that he wasn't really the Messiah, that he didn't fulfill what the Messiah is supposed to do, they stopped following him. But while they were following the false Messiah, I mean, they weren't excommunicated. So I'm not here to define what the transgression is if a person does in fact follow someone that's not the Messiah, and it's a long-term commitment, and even after you see that the person has failed, they continue to follow him, the person's making a very serious mistake. But in dealing with Christianity, there's a much more serious transgression. That a person commits when they accept Christianity. And we're talking at this point specifically for Jewish people. The transgression is the transgression of idolatry. And that is a much more serious transgression than following a quote-unquote false Messiah. And at that point, we can understand that when a Jew worships idolatry, he's committing one of the worst possible sins. It's considered one of the three major sins that a Jew should choose physical death rather than accept Christianity or accept something that's idolatry. The other two sins are murder and adultery. So someone tells you you have to commit one of these sins or we'll kill them. Judaism teaches a person has to choose to die rather than commit one of those three transgressions. So let's take a look at, in this session called Trinity versus Unity, at some of the issues here about what Christianity believes about God, what Judaism believes. And there are two ways of dealing with this. There's a philosophical difference in the way that they view God and the way Judaism views it. And there is a halachic, meaning a legalistic way of what's prohibited and what's not prohibited. In both counts, the concepts within Christianity are unacceptable for Jews. Let's take a look at the way fundamentalist Christians, who are the ones that are actively out missionizing Jewish people, how they present their argument about Jesus. One of the most common quotes that they have is from John 8:58. It reads as follows. Jesus says as follows, "Truly, truly, I say to you, before Abraham was, I am." Now, in and of itself, that verse might not seem very significant. However, evangelicals and fundamentalists will point out that if you go look in Exodus 3:14, where God said to Moses, "I am who I am," they will claim that the word there is in Greek is the same word that was in John 8:58. And Jesus, in fact, was claiming to be God, the same God who appeared to Moses at the burning bush. Some Christians do not use this verse as a proof to Jesus' divinity, but the fundamentalists that I've come into contact usually do. So listen to what they're claiming. They're claiming that Jesus is the same God that appeared to Moses at the burning bush. I am. That represented God in his essence. Let's take a look at a few other verses. In John 1, verse 1 through 14, this verse in John 1, verses 1 through 14, I put 1 through 14 because if you read the whole thing, you'll find it very interesting. But just in short, it says the following. "In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God, and the Word became flesh and dwelt among us." Now, if you do a little equation, and in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was God, and the Word became flesh, so what are they saying? They're saying God became flesh and dwelt among us. So they're not just saying that, you know, they believe in the Trinity. They're saying that God became flesh and blood and dwelt here on earth. Maybe that's why it says in Colossians 2:19, "For in him," meaning Jesus, "all the fullness of deity dwells in bodily form." Now that's an amazing statement. We're not just saying that he's a godly person, as might be anyone else, or that part of God is in this person. This statement says all the fullness of deity dwells in bodily form. And many of the fundamentalists, actually, this is what they believe. Jesus was God. Philippians 2:11. "Every tongue should confess that Jesus Christ is Lord," the verse says. They're claiming he's God. Colossians 1, verse 15. "And he is in the image of the invisible God." So those are quotes from the New Testament, the Christian Bible, that I found that really make it quite clear that evangelicals view Jesus as being God. They use many other verses to quote this. One that we've dealt with in the past is from Isaiah 9:6, where it says, "For a child will be born to us, a son will be given to us, and the government will rest on his shoulders, and his name will be called Wonderful Counselor, Mighty God, Eternal Father, Prince of Peace." We've dealt with that before. But the passage is used by evangelicals to show that Jesus was, in fact, a mighty God and the Eternal Father. Another verse that is often used in Jeremiah 23, verse 6, "And this is his name by which he will be called." And they claim that this is referring to the Messiah. What is this person called? The Lord, our righteousness. Now, if someone's called the Lord, our righteousness, wouldn't you assume that he's God? So I put this following verse to show you that just because something's called the Lord, our righteousness, doesn't make it God. Look in Jeremiah 33:16, you see, it says there, "She," and it's speaking about Jerusalem, "shall be called the Lord, our righteousness." many times we see that individuals or places are called and identified in a very respectful manner with God's name included in it, and it doesn't make them God. It means God's presence is there, or God's presence is manifest through this thing or this person. Jerusalem is called the Lord our righteousness because it represents the center of the world. It represents the holiest place where God is meant to be revealed. So we see here that there's a definite image in Christianity of first and foremost, that God became physical. Okay? There's going to be three aspects to what they believe about God. The first thing is that God, this part of God in Christianity, became physical and dwelt on earth in a physical body. Now, there are other Christian groups, for example, the Mormons, who believe that God, even in heaven, has a physical form, and that all three parts of the Trinity have a physical form. But the fundamentalists view that as idolatrous and being polytheistic. And I often compared it, the jump from Judaism to the Christian belief of the Trinity and Jesus being God in the flesh. If you wanted to get a non-Jew to try to understand how drastic that is for us, just tell them to envision Mormonism and what they believe about God. And the way they feel a repulsion toward the idea of Mormonism, in believing that these three parts of God all have a physical form, is in some way the jump that they did from us. So that's the first aspect. Well, how do we respond to that? This idea that God became physical, or God has some type of form. We look in Deuteronomy 4, verses 15 through 16, and it says the following. Take good heed to yourselves, for you saw no manner of form on the day that the Lord spoke to you in Horeb, out of the midst of the fire, lest you become corrupt and make a carved idol the likeness of any figure of male or female. It's a warning that we're not to envision that God had, at the holiest moment, at the highest level of revelation that God ever gave to the Jewish people. And what does he tell us? Don't envision that God had any shape or form. It says in a few other places, Deuteronomy 5, verse 7 through 8, and Exodus 20, verse 3 and 4, you shall have no other gods besides me. You shall not make for yourself any carved idol or any likeness of anything that is under the heaven above, or that is in the earth below, or in the water under the earth. Okay. These both are basically the same, but what they're saying is, and I emphasize the likeness of anything. You can't compare God to anything, to say he has the likeness of anything, whether it be a man, a woman, an animal, a fish, anything physical. God told us not to believe that. Now, even if you get into the idea of a paradox, where someone would say, well, can't God do anything? If God can do anything, can't he decide to become physical and come dwell in a physical form? So the way I respond to that is as follows. When someone asks me, can God do anything? My answer is no. There are things that God can't do. And that appears to be a limitation. However, if you go a step further, what can't God do? God can't do things that contradict his essence. In other words, God will always exist. That's something. One thing we understand about God. He will always exist, right? So to say, could God destroy himself? that statement is it's a paradox, because to destroy himself goes against his very essence. Okay? Can God create another God? Well, it wouldn't be God, because God didn't have a wasn't created. And to create another God would go against his essence. You're now making something that's created, so it's a paradox. God, by definition, has no shape or form. And to take on a shape or form goes against his very essence. But even if you play games with that philosophical argument, and even if you wanted to take the stance that God could do anything, he said here that we as Jews are prohibited from believing that he would do this, or thinking that he would ever do such a thing. So either way, we're not allowed to believe that God has a physical form. And as it says in Malachi 3:6, for I, the Lord, do not change. God doesn't change. He is what he is. And he won't change into something else. Okay? What is the second thing that evangelical Christians believe about Jesus? First was that they believe it was God becoming physical. Second is that they believe that Jesus is a mediator. That there are these different parts of the Godhead, and that Jesus served as a mediator between man and God the Father. How do we see that? In John 14, verse 6, it says, no one comes to the Father but through me. It's a pretty clear statement. No one gets to God except through Jesus. That's a mediator. It also says in Hebrews 8, 6, he is also a mediator of a better covenant. And in 1 Timothy 2, 5, for there is one God and one mediator also between God and men, the man Jesus Christ. It's very clear that they see him as a mediator. The only way to get to God in heaven is through Jesus. That, without doubt, is the concept of a mediator. Now, why is that prohibited to Jews? Well, all you have to do is look at the second of the Ten Commandments. Deuteronomy 5, verse 7. You shall have no other gods before me. Even if you believe that something is God, but you say, I need to go through that, and I have to place that before I can get to God in heaven, that's a commandment, is a prohibition against having a mediator. Now, oftentimes, I think that's very clear. So we don't believe in mediators. But the question arises, what about the high priest? Wasn't he a mediator for the people? Didn't he lay his hands on the sacrificial lamb? Didn't he send this goat off into the wilderness? Didn't he do all this stuff for the people to help get rid of their sins? Wasn't Moses a mediator when he prayed for the Jewish people? Okay? And you could go even further. How about rabbis? When in Hasidic Judaism, people go to a Rebbe and ask for a blessing. Or in Sephardic community, they go to the Chacham. Or even in any community, when someone is ill and at the Torah reading on the Sabbath, everybody runs up there with the name of their family member and they say a prayer for the sick. Let the sick person pray for himself. Why do they need the congregation praying for him? Isn't that a mediator? Isn't someone else praying for someone else? So no matter to what extreme you take it, how do we respond to that? The simplest answer that I have found has to do with whether the role of this individual is exclusive or not. Does the individual who needs help or is praying to God have the ability to reach God on their own? Or is it only through someone else? A mediator means that you can only reach God through this mediator. When I can reach God on my own, when I can pray to God if I'm ill on my own and get a response to my prayer, it's not a mediator for me to use someone else. It's an aid. It's an advantage. It means that through the holiness of the synagogue, through the holiness of having a quorum of men, through the holiness of having the Torah scroll out, God pays attention, maybe. But not to the exclusion of the individual being able to do it. The same thing with the high priest. Does a person, as we learned earlier, does a person have ability to get rid of their sins on their own? Of course. Does it help to have the high priest do a certain service? It can help. But not to the exclusion of the person doing it by themselves. And that's how it works with it. I'll just tell you a Hasidic story. There was a Hasidic Rebbe, the Baal Shem Tov, the founder of the Hasidic movement. It's a great story to know if anyone accuses the Hasidim of having intermediaries of using a Rebbe. So a family came to the Baal Shem Tov and asked for a blessing to have children. They couldn't have children. So the Baal Shem Tov asked this husband and wife if they want a boy or a girl. So they said, it doesn't matter to us. Whatever blessing we can get for a child, we'll take. He says, it really does make a difference, because if you want a boy, it's going to cost you 100 rubles. If you want a girl, it's 50 rubles. So these people were so poor, they didn't even have one ruble. So he said, listen, you have to go out, you have to spend day and night going door to door, begging for money, collecting the money, and when you get the money, you give it to me and we'll get a blessing for you. So they went out, they tried to raise money, and they were completely unsuccessful. They came back to the Baal Shem Tov, they put a few rubles on the table, and they said, please give us a blessing for a child, we can't raise any more money. And he said, nope, you have to give me exactly what I asked for. The husband got so upset, he picked up the money, he put it in his pocket, and he said, listen, you keep your blessings, we'll keep our money, and we'll pray to God ourselves. And the Baal Shem Tov had a big smile on his face. He says, that's what I wanted. Everybody get the story? He wanted them to do it themselves. They had that ability. Okay? So this idea of a mediator, that we're dependent on a mediator, is considered a prohibition of having other gods before God, before the God in heaven. Okay? Now, the third thing that Christians believe about God, besides that Jesus became God in the flesh and that he served as a mediator, this is the most dramatic. And that is that Christians believe that God exists as a Trinity. Where do we see this? And the concept of a Trinity is nothing new. Prior to Christianity, Greek and Roman mythology was full of these concepts of a Trinity. In the same way we said earlier, it had the concept of a virgin birth, it had the concept of sin being taken away through the shedding of blood. Most of the concepts that are not Jewish in Christianity came from paganism. I would say all the concepts that are in Christianity that are not have some Jewish root are from paganism. We see the Romans had a trinity, which was Jupiter, June, and Minerva. Because Minerva had a big nerve. Okay? Remember it that way. So they had a concept of a trinity. So it was something that was very easy for these Gentile Christians to accept, this idea of a trinity. And in fact, at the Council of Nicaea, the Emperor Constantine of the Roman Empire in 325 CE, is when they actually sat down and really defined what Christians believe about God. And they came to the conclusion that they do in fact believe in this Trinity. Where do they get this idea that God is a Trinity? That he exists as a plurality? Well, if you look in Genesis 1, verse 1, it's where they all start. It says, in the beginning, God, Elohim, the word is in plural, created the heaven and the earth. They say, since Elohim, God, has a plural ending, it hints to the fact, or it shows us, that God is a plurality. So they already start to think that God exists as a duality rather than something that's completely singular. The problem with that is we see in Psalm 82, verse 8, that it says, arise, O God, using the same word Elohim, judge the earth. This word, Elohim, refers to God as a judge, as He judges the earth. And the word, in fact, Elohim, or Elohim, in Exodus 21, verse 6, refers to human beings that are judges. Then his master shall bring him to the judges. So God, in fact, set himself up as a judge over the world. He now created the world, and he used the word Elohim to refer to himself because there is a duality. There's God and here's creation. And he functions as a judge over that creation. And there are many words in Hebrew that have this plural ending. The Im, the Yud Mem. And it doesn't make them more than one. Mayim, Panim. You can think of lots of words like that that have a plural ending. And it just means that in Hebrew grammar that it represents something that's all-encompassing. The person's face is all-encompassing of who they are. We see also in Exodus 7, verse 1, the word Elohim is used to refer to Moses. I have made you Moses as a God, Elohim, to Pharaoh. And it was only one Moses. Not two. It's interesting that the word Elohim is always used when we refer to false gods, this aspect of plurality, where there appears to be other things besides God. And we have to start keeping that in mind, because that's part of the philosophical thing, that we live in a world of duality, where we could pick any physical object and think that it's God. And we have to differentiate between what we appear to see and what is the real truth and essence about what God really is. But we're going to get to that soon. Another verse that Christians use to show that there's a duality in God is Genesis 1:26, where it says, "Let us make man in our image." And we dealt with this a few sessions ago. And it's usually explained as either referring to the creation, that God was speaking to the creation and involving it in the creation, the formation of man, or as we see in Daniel 2:36, 2 Samuel 16:20, and Ezra 4:18, where it says, "Now we shall tell its interpretation." Daniel was speaking, and he spoke in the plural because he spoke in what is called the majestic plural, not necessarily referring to God in being pluralistic. But God, being a king, speaks in this majestic plural. One that's really cute, we find in Genesis 18, verse 1 and 2. This is a very famous story of Abraham, who is recovering from his circumcision. And he's sitting in the tent, the doorway to his tent. And it says, "Now the Lord appeared to him by the oaks of Mamre, while he was sitting at the tent door in the heat of the day. When he lifted up his eyes and looked, behold, three men were standing opposite him. And when he saw them, he ran and bowed himself to the earth." So they will argue, here we have Abraham sitting in the doorway, and God appears to him in the form of three men. Which I could never understand, because I thought the Trinity, only one part became physical. But they go on and they say that you later see that two of them depart and go to Sodom and Gomorrah. And God and Abraham sits there remaining, speaking to the Lord. So they say, you see, but was he physical? It was three men that came. So there's an inconsistency there. What in fact is happening here in this story? It sounds pretty strange. According to our tradition, these three men were angels. We can see that they were angels from Genesis 19, verse 1. Where after they finish speaking to Abraham, two of them go off to Sodom and Gomorrah. As it says, "Now the two angels came to Sodom." So we see that they were angels. But what about the third one? So you have to understand something about angels. The Hebrew word is malach. A malach is a messenger. Okay? And it's used in the Tanakh to represent anyone that's a messenger. Now, a messenger in Judaism, an angel, a malach, is sent on one mission at a time. It can't perform more than one mission at a time. It doesn't have free will to do that. One of the ways we see that is that in the conversation between these angels and Abraham, if you go read all of these verses, whenever they're speaking about their mission, these angels speak in the singular. But whenever they're speaking about things that are not a part of their mission, it speaks in the plural. For example, it says, we will sit down and wash our feet, or we will sit down and eat something. It had nothing to do with their mission. It spoke in the plural. But when one angel came to announce that Sarah would have a child, it was in the singular. When one came to heal Abraham, it was in the singular. When one of them comes to destroy Sodom, it's in the singular. When one of them comes to save Lot's life, it's in the singular. These three angels, the reason God sent three is because each one had a different mission. One's job was to announce the good tidings that Sarah would have a child. One's job was to first and foremost heal Abraham from his circumcision, and later to go on and in the same way as healing someone to save Lot and his family. He had the same type of mission, but two different times. And one angel was sent to destroy the city of Sodom and Gomorrah. The first angel that gave the good news to Sarah, it didn't have to stay any longer because it finished its purpose. So that's why only two angels went to go to Sodom. One to save the family, one to destroy Sodom. So later, if you read in this verse where it says, and Abraham still stood there before the Lord, who was he speaking to? Was he speaking to the third angel? Well, according to Jewish tradition, it's obvious that he wasn't. In fact, what happened here, and the Talmud uses this story to teach us the importance of hospitality. How so? According to our understanding of the scripture, what in fact happened was, God appeared spiritually to Abraham, as he had done many times before. Why did he appear to him? Because Abraham was very sad. Because he was unable to entertain guests, it says. Why? Because God brought out the heat of the day to make it so hot that travelers wouldn't come through the desert. Why did God want that? Because he wanted to protect Abraham, that during the 3 days that he was recuperating from his operation, he wouldn't be bothered by anyone. Abraham was so pained by that, that he started praying to God, and God appeared to him. God answered his prayer by sending three angels in the form of men, and they were only angels, not God, in the form of men, in order to be his guests. But at the same time they were accomplishing their missions. At the moment that Abraham saw the three men, what did he do? If you're reading, he says to God, please, my Lord, don't turn aside from me. Who was he speaking to? He wasn't speaking to the three angels. He was speaking to God. He says, excuse me, I'm going to go take care of these guests now. The Talmud says, we learn from that greeting guests into our home is equivalent to greeting God's presence, bringing God's presence into our home. So he put God on hold. It may sound rude, but the Talmud teaches us that it's a great thing to welcome guests into our home. He put God on hold for a second, said, please don't leave. I'll be right back after I finish this. And after the angels left, and he's standing still before the Lord, he went back to talking to God. Okay, that's a Jewish interpretation to it. I just gave that because they do use this verse. Another verse that they use to show this plurality of God is Psalm 110, verse 1, which is CV stands for the Christian version. The Lord said to my Lord, sit at my right side. Doesn't it sound like God is speaking to another God? The Lord said to my Lord, sit at my right side. So they say the second Lord is Jesus. The Hebrew word there is Adoni. Anybody ever been to Israel? If you're ever on a bus in Israel and you see a woman with six kids in a carriage and she wants to get out of the bus, she's going to scream, Slicha Adoni. And if she's really nervous, she's going to say, Slicha Adoni, Ani Yoredet. And she's going to start screaming. You hear it all the time on the buses. Right? Adoni in Hebrew doesn't mean God. It means my master. The Hebrew word here, Adoni, means my master. So the verse should read, and God said to my master. Now who is it speaking about? It's speaking about King David. Because who's saying these psalms? The Levites in the temple. And they're speaking about how God spoke to my master, meaning King David. And we see in 1 Kings 1 verse 17, and she said to him, speaking about David, my Lord, Adonai. The word is there, you know, is used to refer to King David. Okay? Spelled the same way in Hebrew. Now they bring in other things about this passage that it says he'll be a priest like Melchizedek, who was a great priest that lived at the time of Abraham. And they say, if it's talking about David, David wasn't a priest. But in fact, there are verses that the Kohanim are referred to, the descendants of David and kings are referred to as being Kohanim, people that minister in the temple or in important offices. And if we wanted to, we could go into depth about this, but we're not going to at this time. Last but not least, in their attempt to show that there's a plurality, and this one you'll like, let's take Isaiah 48, verse 16. And now the Lord God sent me and His Spirit. When they quote a verse like this, they're trying to show that there's a Trinity because there are many different people mentioned here, personalities. There's the Lord, there's the God, and there's His Spirit. Okay? Or in Isaiah 48, verse 17, it says, thus says the Lord, your Redeemer, the Holy One of Israel. So anytime it mentions God three places, they're going to say that represents the Trinity. Because look, there's the Lord, there's the Redeemer, and the Holy One of Israel. So I found a very interesting verse in Deuteronomy 32, verse 39. It says, see now that I, even I, am He, and there is no God with me. So if you start counting them up, you get I, even I, He, and me is four, so maybe God is a... Is that what is that? A plurality. Okay? It's just ridiculous to think that just because God has these different names that that represents that God has four parts. What it does mean is that God manifests Himself to the creation in many different ways. But it's not limited to three ways. There are actually seven different names for God in the Torah. So we could say God manifests Himself in seven ways to the creation. God has, how many divine attributes do we say that God has? Anybody know? 13. So we could say that God has 13 more. So it's really 20 gods, or 20 aspects. You have to differentiate between how God exists in His essence and how He interacts with the creation, manifests Himself to the creation. And this is more of the philosophical difference between Judaism and Christianity. But before we get into that, you have to understand, for a Jew to believe there's anything else except God is considered idolatry. To say that there's a Trinity and that it has parts and that those things are God or parts of God is considered idolatry for Jews. Okay? Philosophically, the reason that's unacceptable, we're going to see in a minute. But Christians want to try to explain philosophically that in fact God does exist as a plurality. Philosophically. They use the most amazing verse to prove it. Which verse? Deuteronomy 6:4. What does it say? Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one. Notice, Lord, God, Lord, three times, even the Lord is twice. So it's really only two different names, but three times they used. And they point out that it says Echad, God is Echad. Anybody here not know what the word Echad means when they say the Shema? Raise your hand if you don't know what that word means. The word Echad means one. This verse says, the Lord our God, the Lord is one. It doesn't say that there is one God. It says the Lord is one. Meaning, what is God? He is one. Now, Christians try to show that this prayer that we say twice a day, the Shema, that we believe rules out the possibility of there being a Trinity, because Trinity is three, not one. Christians want to show that in fact this very verse, this word Echad, proves a Trinity. It's amazing. How do they do it? They say that the word Echad doesn't mean the absolute oneness of God. And in one of the handouts from Maimonides, he says on page 34b, number 7, it says, "This God is one," Maimonides writes. "He is not two, nor more than two, but one." So that none of the things existing in the universe to which the term one is applied is like unto his unity. Maimonides is this differentiating between... Now listen to what he said here. "Nothing that exists in the universe to which the term one is applied is like the oneness of God." They're not the same. Why does he say that? Why does he say that God is not like the one that's in the universe? Because Christians happen to give us an answer to that, because they say the word one isn't an absolute unity, which Maimonides says God is. They say this one is a composite unity. For example, Genesis 1:5, "And there was evening and there was morning, one day." This one day is a composite of two things: evening and morning. Numbers 13:23 says, "A branch with one cluster of grapes." This one cluster of grapes is a composite of many grapes. So what are they saying, Christians, when they use this argument? They're saying that the word Echad refers to a composite oneness. For example, my pen in my hand right here. It is a composite of many things. It is a composite of ink, metal, and plastic. How many pens do I have in my hand? One. How many parts does it have? At least three. So they're saying, philosophically, that the Shema teaches that God is like a fountain pen. He's one God, but he's Echad, which Echad can refer to a composite. So there can be one God made up of three parts. Why not? The word Echad doesn't teach that he's one without parts. That's their argument. Everybody follow that? What they're trying to prove with the word Echad? They'll go so far to say that had God wanted us to believe that God is a non-composite oneness, it wouldn't have used the word Echad. It would have used the Hebrew word Yachid. Yachid means unique. Okay? I have one pen in my hand. Why? I say one because I don't have two pens, or three, or four. But all these pens have something in common. They're pens. There's nothing unique about this. Okay? But let's say no other pens existed. Then I could say, this pen is unique. I can't say this pen is unique, because there are many pens. When you have something unique, it means there's nothing else like it. You can't even compare it to something else. A sequence of numbers isn't even applicable when you say something's unique. It's unique. I don't even have to think about if there's something else. There's nothing else. Unique rules out the possibility of there being something else. Does that make sense? When I say something's unique, when I say there's one, it means that there's not two. So Maimonides is defining this oneness of God as being unique. God's unique. So the question is, why in the Shema didn't it use the word Yachid? God is unique. There's nothing else like him. Well, the reason is, first of all, because the word Echad is not always used to refer to a composite unity. In Exodus 10:19, we see that it says, "There remain not one locust." The word Echad there is used not in the sense of a composite oneness. Or when it says in Exodus 11:1, yet one more plague. It's not a composite. And in Ecclesiastes 4:8, it says the most amazing statement, there is one, not two, showing us that the number one rules out the possibility of there being two. Now, this idea of a trinity and a composite unity is nothing new to Christianity. Fundamentalists didn't make it up last year. In the Disputation of Barcelona that Nachmanides had in 1263 CE, and you have it in your handout, we see that the trinity is compared to wine. Color, taste, and smell. It's one thing, it's a bottle of wine, but the wine has three aspects to it. But if you've read Nachmanides' writings, he quickly disproves this by showing that all three of these things are independent of one another. And you can change one and it may not affect the others. Each one is finite. Okay? And let's delve into this philosophically. What is God? How does he exist in his essence? We respond like this. We can understand what God isn't. Is God physical? No. Is God limited? No. Is God above time and space? Does he transcend time and space? Yes. We have to understand, first of all, how does God exist in his essence? In Isaiah 48, verse 12, one thing we learn about God is it says, I am he, I am the first, and I am the last. God says about himself that he's the first and the last. That means that God has no beginning, and he has no end. Does everybody follow that? That God has no beginning and he has no end? Raise your hand if you follow that. Because if you don't, it's really important to stop me right now. God has no beginning and he has no end. He's the first and he's the last. Okay? To the extent that it says, to thee it was shown that you should know that the Lord is God and there is none else besides him. Right now we're talking about how God exists in his essence. In God's essence, there's nothing else besides him. Because he just exists. That's why we can say he just goes on forever. He has no beginning, no end. There's nothing else besides God, the Torah says. Let me give you a practical example. I have in my hand a pen. Can anybody see a beginning point on this pen? Raise your hand. Everybody's hand goes up. You can all see a point where it begins. Now, each of you have found a different point. How many people looked over to the right and saw that as the beginning point? A few hands go up. How many people possibly looked on this side and said that's a beginning point? How many thought that maybe over here are beginning points? Right? Few people. Now, I would like everybody to look at the pen. How many people see an ending point? Raise your hand. Everybody. It has a beginning and it has an end. Each point, depending on how you look at it, is a beginning point or an ending point. Why? Because this pen is finite. Finite means it has a beginning and an end. It has physical limitations. Beginning point and an end point. Therefore, it can exist within, it can be a physical object. Because in order for something to exist physically, it has to have time and it has to have space. If this is the beginning point, that's the ending point, there's a certain amount of time that it takes to go from one point to the other. I'm not a physicist, so I'm not going to try to get into this, because I don't understand it myself from physics, but I know simplistically, this pen is finite. It has beginning points and ending points. By definition, we're saying that God isn't like this pen. He doesn't have a beginning and he doesn't have an end. Now, let's step back again. Since this pen exists, what's on the other side of where it ends? Air. Depends. If you're on the inside of the pen, it's maybe air inside, or if this plastic ends, it's the ink, or where the plastic ends, it's the metal. There's something else there. In other words, since it's finite, something can exist on the other side of it, so to speak. And there could even be another side. There can be sides. You can distinguish between these things. And in fact, on the other side of this pen is my finger, because I'm holding it. I exist. Because where the pen ends, my finger begins. And where my finger ends, the pen begins. Correct? That's pretty simple, isn't it? Let me ask you a question. Let's say the pen went on forever, and it never ended. There was never a beginning point. There was never an ending point. It just, imagine it just went on to such an extent, it's like a plane of height, what is it? Height, width, and length that just go on forever. And it just, there's nothing else except that. It's hard to envision, because you just kind of see it starting at this point and going out, but that's time that it's moving out. What if it all there was is pen? Nothing else existed. There's nothing else except pen. It just went on. No beginning point. You could never find a beginning point. You could never find an ending point. Could anything else exist? If this pen went on forever, could you exist? Could anyone else in this room exist? Because by definition, the minute you existed, what would that mean? The pen stopped someplace. It stopped where you are. It means it had a beginning or an end. Does that make sense? So, the pen doesn't work like that. The pen is finite. But by definition, God exists that He has no beginning and no end. Nothing else, and that's why we say nothing else exists besides Him, in His essence. Because the minute something else existed besides Him, what would it mean about God? It means He's finite. It means He stopped. So when we speak about God in His essence, we speak of Him transcending time and space and nothing else existing besides Him, and He goes on and there's no beginning and there's no end. There's not even time. You can't even define it as saying God goes on forever. The way He's defined is there's nothing else besides God. Now that's how He exists in His essence. There is a name of God that refers to that. That is the four-letter name of God, Yud, and then a He, and then a Vav, and a He, or affectionately called Yud He Vav He, or Yud K Vav He, or in English, YHVH. And that name of God, which is translated as the Lord, represents, whenever that word is used, whenever we find that four-letter word, it speaks about God as He exists in His essence and transcends time. That word, Yud, and then a He and a Vav He, comes from the Hebrew in Exodus 3:14 that says, and God said to Moses, I will be what I will be. God didn't say, as Christians pointed out earlier, I am what I am. He said, I will be what I will be. And that word in Hebrew, Eyeh Asher Eyeh, forms the to-be verb in past, present, and tense. And past, present, and future tense, representing that God exists past, present, and future all equally. He transcends time. So that name of God represents that. The name of God, Elohim, which we use, that Christians pointed out was plural, represents God as He relates to the creation. Now we're going to get into something else. You've got this image of God as He exists, as He transcends the world, and nothing else exists Him. Is that what it appears to be like down here in this physical world? That there's nothing else besides God? Is that the way it appears down here? Absolutely not. Why? Because now that God made a creation. And the creation, even though it's part of God and it's His creation, it's something that He made to appear and be, for all practical purposes, separate from God. The pen, for example. Does anyone in this whole class ever think that the pen was God? It appears to be separate from God because it's His creation. When I say a word, when I say hello and I create the word, hello, the word appears to be separate from me. But as long as I'm saying it exists, it's still connected to me. Okay? So we see this Elohim, this name of God Elohim, which is, has a plural ending, represents God as he relates to creation, as there appears to be duality and plurality. And what did we say about those two names of God? One that represents God transcending time, and one representing God as he reveals himself or manifests himself into creation. You see the two differences? What did we say about them? Look back up at Deuteronomy 4:35. To thee was shown that you should know that the Lord, Yud-Kei-Vav-Kei, as he transcends time and space, is Elohim. They're one and the same. It's not anything different. And as we see in Jeremiah 10:10, the Lord is the true God. What's the truth? What's the real thing? This level of God where he's Yud-Kei-Vav-Kei, that he transcends time and space. However, we live in a physical world, in creation. This is our reality. This is what we see. Look at Isaiah 45, verse 5. I am the Lord, Yud-Kei-Vav-Kei, and there is none else. There is no God, Elohim, besides me. Okay? God exists in his essence. There's nothing else besides him. Now, if I haven't completely confused you and lost you, well, let's go back to the Shema. If we go back to the Shema, hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one. Think of it in terms like this. Let's retranslate that. Hear, O Israel. That's not hard, is it? God speaking to Jews. Hear, O Israel, the Lord. Now, what does that word represent? God as he transcends time and space. Do we see that reality? No. Does anyone here see that only God exists? Raise your hand if you do. I don't. Hear, O Israel, the Lord, who in his essence transcends time, space, and matter, and has no beginning and end. Elokeinu, our God, who is in the world and manifests himself in the physical creation. The Lord is one. The real truth is, what's one? That all of that, this plurality, is all part of this oneness of God. It just appears to be separate. Now, we could go into a whole physical thing about how God created things and made them appear separate, but I don't want to go into depth with it. I just want to give one little parable, one little example, I mean. The closest thing that we can envision that is like this God that has no limits and just goes on is light. Imagine yourself in a mountain range where it's been snowing for 6 days and 6 nights, and you're middle of a blizzard. And there's so much whiteness and so much light. What happens to your eyes? Anybody go skiing? You become snowblind. There's so much light you can't see. Right? You can't function. There's only light. Nothing else appears to exist. What does a person who's skiing in a situation like that do in order to enable themselves to see things? They put dark goggles on. Now, what do the goggles do? Do they actually change the reality of what's out there? No, it's still light, and it's still snow, and it's still what's out there. But what does it change? It changes the intensity of the light that the person perceives. And the darker the glasses, the more different the reality appears to the person. If I put a little glasses that are, you know, like this, that get dark, it appears a little bit different. What if I put on glasses that were almost completely black? I would almost be able to function. You ever see those commercials where they put on the glasses and without them you can't see anything out there, and then you put them on and all of a sudden there's a little kid running across in front of your car? He was there all the time. You just couldn't see it because there was so much light. When there's only God in his essence, you can't see anything. Nothing else can exist because there's only God. When you conceal light, you get the opposite, darkness. Is it really dark out there? No, it's really just light, but it appears to be dark. So the opposite of light is darkness. How do you get that? By concealing the light. If God is infinite without beginning and end, transcending time and space, if you were to conceal that to the creation, what would be the opposite? Instead of being infinite and without beginning and end, what would you get? Finite. So through a process called creation, what God did is he concealed himself to us. He concealed his essence. And but through that concealment, it appears to be finite. The table's really here. That's what we call creation. But if you were to take away this creative power, which we could call concealment, what would be here? Godliness. The essence of everything is godliness. So the Shema is saying this. The Shema is speaking to Jewish people that live in a world where there appears to be which one of those two names of God? Yud-Kei Vav-Kei, where He transcends time and space, or Elohim, where it appears to be duality. Who's God speaking to? Which one of those two? Elohim, where God appears to be plurality, and physical, and finite. And listen what He's saying. Hear, O Israel, the Lord, who transcends time and space, and is also Elokeinu, and you might think that that's who He is. It's only one thing. What is that one thing? The essence, the Lord, who transcends time and space. In fact, this word Echad comes to rule out the possibility that it's two. See, Echad is necessary in the Shema because it's speaking to us as we live in this world of plurality, where we could think that there are many things that are God. There's you, and there's me, and there's the desk, and there's the book, and there's the pen, and there's the lights, and there's plants, and there's animals, and there's Jesus, and there's Trinity, and there's Jupiter, and there's all these things. And we live in a reality where we see this plurality. And we could think that there's not one, that there are two, or three, or 15, or 20, or 30. And therefore, it can't use the word Yechid. Because Yechid is only applicable when there's no other possibility of anything else existing. But do we live in that reality? That reality only exists as God in His essence. We live in a reality of creation. So the Shema says, listen, Jews, there's only one God who exists above time and space. He manifests Himself to you in the physical creation. But the reality, beyond what you think you're seeing, is that there's only one thing. There's one God. God who transcends time and space. It's not duality. You think there's duality, you see duality, but it's not. It's not two, it's one. Does that make sense? I know it's very complicated, but I think I explained it in a way that starts to make a little bit of sense. And that's why in Deuteronomy 32, verse 39, it says, see now that I, even I, am He, and there is no God with me. We used that before, but now we can use it differently. God is saying, I exist and there's nothing with me. In His essence, there's nothing else. In the world, it could appear to be plurality, but is that the truth? Is that what God really is? No, He's really just one. So let's think about how this applies to the Trinity. If God, we're not talking about God as how He reveals, how He manifests Himself. That's just manifestations. Christians believe that God in His essence exists as this Trinity. Now that we have a better understanding about how we see God in His essence, that He transcends time and space, could you ever contemplate that God had three parts? It just doesn't make sense. Because if He's infinite, with no beginning and no end, nothing else can exist. How can you differentiate between the Father and the Son and the Holy Ghost if that's God in His essence? If you want to say it's not God in His essence, that God in His essence is above time and space. And He reveals Himself and He manifests Himself in different ways. So, maybe it's true, maybe it's not true. But that's not what Christians are saying. Christians are saying God in His essence. The Trinity is how God exists in His essence. It's a mystery to them, how they claim. It's a mystery of the oneness. But to a Jew, it is philosophically idolatry. It transcends that concept. That's philosophically. Halachically, we don't even have to get this involved. The mere fact that we say there's anything else except God is prohibited to Jews. Okay? Now what about non-Jews? Okay, let's stop for a second. Before I get into what non-Jews are allowed to do and not do. Does everybody follow basically why the belief in the Trinity, God dwelling in a bodily form, and Jesus as a mediator is idolatry? Anybody have any problems understanding? Raise your hand if you have any problem at all understanding why that appears to be idolatry. Let's just go over quickly again. To say that He's physical in form goes against all the verses that said not to envision that God would have or take on any form, even if we were to argue somehow that He could do it. We were told not to believe that. But we see that He can't, because it goes against His essence. That He can't be a mediator, we saw already that goes against the statement, you shall have no other gods before me. that God exists as a Trinity, that He has these different aspects. And they're very careful not to say that God has parts. They're aspects of one thing. But by the mere fact that you can say that there's three rather than four, in itself shows that the thing is finite. And if you can distinguish between the Father and the Son and the Holy Ghost, if you can somehow distinguish between their roles, then each one has its own limitation. And it goes against this understanding of God's unity that we have. What about non-Jews? Are they worshipping idolatry by believing in the Trinity? It's a very good question. According to Jewish philosophy, there is a concept called shituv. The Hebrew word shituv means partnership. That as long as someone believes, this is not for Jews. Jews are only allowed to believe that there's God. No partnership. There is a concept that God exists as God and that He works through different things. He works through the sun, He works through the moon, He works through all kinds of different things. He's a partner with, those things are His partners. He's like, as my teacher says, God's the chairman of the board and He has representatives. That's called shituv. There is a concept in Judaism called shituv. Okay? Almost all rabbinical authorities say that Christianity is shituv. That they believe in God and that they have these other parts besides Him that He works through. He does through the Son, He does this, and through the Holy Spirit, He does that. But they believe in a God, the Father. It's considered shituv. For a Jew, is that acceptable? No. Why? Because a Jew was commanded, "Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one." You're not allowed to believe in anything except one God. No partners, no nothing else besides that. So for a Jew, that concept of a shituv, we were commanded not to accept it. Were Gentiles told to not have shituv? We were. According to Maimonides, he says they were. He actually goes so far as to say Christianity is idolatry. But the majority of Jewish commentaries say no. Gentiles were only commanded to believe in God, but not to believe in Him without partnership. We, at the giving of the Torah, were commanded to go a step beyond just belief in God, but to believe that He can't be a partnership, that He's only one. One verse that's used to try to show this is in Deuteronomy 4, verse 19, where it says, "Beware, lest you lift your eyes to heaven and see the sun and the moon and the stars and all the hosts of heaven, and be drawn away and worship them and serve them, those which the Lord your God has allotted to all the peoples under the whole earth." The verse sounds like it's saying that these things like the heaven and the sun were given to the Gentiles, but not the Jews. Meaning, as long as they believe that there's a God, if they want to give some authority or some respect to these other things, they're allowed. As long as they believe that there is a supreme God that rules over them. The minute they start worshiping the sun as God, that's idolatry. Or they worship the moon as God. But if they have it as a partnership, it's okay. Huh? That's a good question. Let's wait a minute. Okay? How is this possible that there's a double standard? Doesn't it sound like a double standard? We're saying that for a non-Jew to believe in the Trinity, he's not transgressing. Why? Because he was only commanded to believe that there's a God. And he does. He wasn't commanded to go a step further and believe that God exists as an absolute oneness. For a Jew, we're commanded to believe in a God who's an absolute oneness. Therefore, we couldn't accept the concept of a Trinity. Sounds like a double standard? Guess what? It is. It is a double standard. In the same way that Jews are prohibited. Let's take the parallel. Jews are prohibited from believing in shituv, partnership. But Gentiles aren't. Jews are prohibited from eating pork. But Gentiles aren't. It's a double standard. It's a double. It is a double standard. Okay. How did this double standard come into being? And the answer is because Jews and Gentiles are under two different covenants. The whole world is originally under the covenant found in Genesis 9, verses 12 through 13. The covenant that Noah made with all of his, with God made with Noah and all of his descendants. God said to Noah, "This is the token of the covenant which I make between me and you and every living creature that is with you for perpetual generations. I have set my bow in the cloud, and it shall be for a token." God made a covenant with Noah. We call that the Noahide covenant. It consists of seven basic categories of laws, of things that Gentiles have to believe and not do. We mentioned earlier that the reason there are seven colors in a rainbow because it represents these seven commandments. And in that covenant, Gentiles, non-Jews, are commanded to believe in a God. Not to blaspheme Him, not to worship idolatry, to set up courts of law, not to murder, not to steal, not to eat the flesh of an animal that's still living. So if they worship idolatry, if it's really idolatry that they're worshiping something that's God that isn't, then they're committing a sin. But if they believe in God and just believe that He has these partnerships, so, it's not idolatry for them. But the Jews were given a different covenant. At Mount Sinai, we were given the covenant of the Torah. It added many things to the Noahide covenant. And I mentioned earlier that Ruth, who was the epitome of the example of a convert to Judaism, her name is the numerical value of what? 606. Because 606 and is the number of commandments she accepted upon herself after she converted, because she already had the seven from the Noahide covenant. And the 606 and the seven add up to the 613 commandments of the Torah. So we were commanded additional things, which meant we could not believe in this partnership or trinity. Anybody follow that? The question always comes up, but if Jesus isn't God and I worship Him, the Christians will say, I'm worshiping someone that's not God. Fine. If that's all you worship, it's idolatry. But if you believe that there is a supreme God, so God didn't prohibit you from thinking that He works through different things, even maybe through a person. But for a Jew, there's no question it's considered idolatry. Because we were given an additional commandment. And it's so serious that we see that if a Jew worships idolatry, he can no longer be considered a Jew. That's how serious it is. Now, that's not an absolute statement. He's not considered a Jew or called a Jew in the fact that he's not allowed to participate in the Jewish community. But he still retains a certain essential part of himself that's Jewish. What does that mean? A Jew who's born Jewish or a person that converts according to Jewish law is Jewish. No matter what they do, they can never stop being a Jew. What does that mean? What does it mean to be a Jew? This definition is that a Jewish person is born with an obligation to keep the Torah and to serve God. Or if they convert, they take on that responsibility like Ruth did. My God is your God. Your God is my God. I will go where you go, she said. She accepted upon herself all that responsibility. Once that person is Jewish, they can never lose that responsibility to keep the Torah and to being Jewish. If they go and worship idolatry, as long as they're worshiping it, we don't call them a Jew. We don't consider them part of the Jewish community. But they always retain the obligation to leave the idolatry and to return back to Judaism, to that obligation of keeping the Torah. Where do we see this in the Torah? We find it in the book of Kings, 1 Kings 18, verse 21. What does it say there? There is a story, and I think we may have gone over this before, of Jews who were worshiping an idol. The idol is called Baal. And when Eliyahu goes to them, Elijah the prophet, and he says to them, I don't want you worshipping this idolatry. What does he say? He says, how long will you waver between two opinions? If the Lord is God, follow Him. If Baal is God, follow Him. He gave them a choice. Now, what kind of prophet is this? How do you give Jews a choice? Tell them, don't worship Baal, just be Jewish. He didn't. He said, be one or the other. Don't waver between. He had to make that statement because these people were Jews for Baal. They were running around with t-shirts that said, Baal made me kosher. Jews for Baal. At the same time that they were worshipping Baal, they were calling themselves Jews. They felt that they were doing something Jewish. They were still connected to Judaism. Elijah said, you can't be both. Don't waver in between. You're either this way or you're either that way. You can't be both. If you believe in Baal, you're a Baalite. If you believe in Jesus, you're a Christian. If you don't, and you believe in Judaism, you're Jewish. You can't be both. He said, don't waver. What was he saying? As long as you worship Baal, you can't be called a Jew. But he, if you read the story, it goes on, he calls them to repentance. He tells them you have an everlasting obligation to leave Baal and come back to Judaism. And in fact, that's what happens. They do give it up and they come back. This is the obligation that every Jew has. If they're worshipping idolatry, they're not considered part of the Jewish community. They're not called. They only retain this responsibility to repent and come back to Judaism. That's what the Talmud means when it says that even though a Jew sins, he's still a Jew. He's still a Jew in the fact that he's obligated to live a life as a Jew. He can't decide one day, I want to be no longer Jew, no more obligation. Judaism sees him that he always has that obligation. And this is the essence of what it means to be a Jew. We have different terminologies for Jewish people. Today we say we are Jewish, from the Hebrew word Yehudi. What other words do we use to refer to ourselves as Jews?
Yisrael.
Or even go far enough back, we say Ivri. Abraham was an Ivri, a Hebrew. He came from over the other side of the river, Ivri. Which term is used to refer to a Jewish person, to tell them they're a Jew today? Not Israel, because Israel was a tribe. And we'll see, Yehuda was also a tribe. There are many tribes. What? He was the father of all the tribes. So there are people that say we're descendants of Israel. We're the people of Israel. But let's see where this term is used. The word Yehudi is utilized in Tanakh to tell us that a person is a Jew. In Daniel 3:12, it says, there are certain Jews, and it uses the word Yehudim. But how does it define them? What made them Jewish? They do not serve gods, nor do they worship the golden image which thou hast set up. What made them Jews is by the fact that they wouldn't worship idolatry, that they only wanted to worship God. That is what the essence of a Jew is, to worship God and serve Him. And we see this again in Esther 2:5, where Mordechai, it says, there was a Jew, Yehudi, Mordechai. Did you ever hear about Mordechai? He's called Mordechai HaYehudi, Mordechai the Jew. You might think that he's Yehudi because he's from the tribe of Yehuda. But if we read this verse in Esther 2:5, there was a Jew Mordechai, a Benjamite. He was from Binyamin, not Yehuda. He's called Yehudi, not because he's from the tribe of Yehuda. So those that will say, well, there are, and the Mormons say this, I heard it recently on a tape, there are people that are descendants of Abraham, and they are Semites. They're from Shem and Abraham. There are people that are descendants from Israel, from Yaakov and Yisrael. And therefore the Mormons will say we're also Israelites because they say they're from Ephraim. And then there are Jews who are from the tribe of Yehuda. But by Judaism, we are not called Jews. We are probably most likely from either the tribe of Yehuda or Binyamin today, most of us today, because those are the two tribes that weren't taken into exile. But we're not called Yehudim because we're from the tribe of Yehuda. Even a Kohen who's from the tribe of Levi is called a Yehudi. Why is the term Yehudi referred to us? Because we don't worship idolatry. Because we serve God. Because we don't worship God as having a form. And we don't think He has three parts. Because we worship our God and serve Him. That's what makes us Yehudi. And if you look at the word Yehudi in Hebrew, and let's look at another verse. Esther 3, verse 4 and 5. He was a Jew, Yehudi. Mordechai did not bow or pay homage to him. Mordechai wouldn't bow down in the same way that Daniel and his friends wouldn't. That's what it means to be a Jew, to not worship idolatry. If we look at the word Yehudi in Hebrew, it's very interesting. Yehudi is spelled Yud, Hey, Vav, Dalid, Yud. Okay? Let's write it on a piece of paper. Yud, Hey, Vav, Dalid, Yud. Okay, we have it here. Yud, Hey, Vav, Dalid, Yud. What's interesting to note is that the first three letters, anybody notice where we've been mentioning them before tonight? Yud, Hey, Vav. First three letters of God's name as He represents transcending time, space, and matter. What letter is missing? A Hey. The Hebrew letter Dalet, according to Jewish mysticism, represents Dalut. Dalut means poverty, emptiness. Yud in Hebrew represents God, that essential point. Yehudi is a person who's always constantly striving after God. He feels a lacking, a poorness in himself if he doesn't have God that he's striving after. And what happens to the Yehudi when he finally gets God and he brings it down into his name? What does he get? Yud, Hey, Vav. And the letter becomes, the dollar with the little Yud down here becomes a Hey. He draws God down into the creation, into the world. And anyone that says a Jew isn't spiritual, because we're so involved in the commandments and in the laws and in keeping kosher and wearing yarmulkes and this, they're missing the whole essential point of what the word Jew means. The whole word Jew, Yehudi, represents a person that's not complete unless he's bringing godliness down into revealing it in the world. And then his name represents, when we live as Jews, and I don't mean planting trees in Israel, and I don't mean giving money to do this or that and the other for poor people. I mean living a life as a Jew where we are trying to keep not just two or three of the commandments. Charity is a commandment. Planting trees in Israel is a mitzvah. It's helping raise up the land. But it's only 613. When we as Jews live our life that we are trying our best to keep all of the Torah to the best of our ability, our life becomes a representation of God in the world. We are God's representatives. And it says in Jewish sources, we as Jews, when we live this lifestyle of Torah and mitzvahs, are shluchim of God, are emissaries of God in the world to stand for Him. That's why when we go against God's will in public, for example, and we do something against His will, what's it called? It's called the Chilul Hashem, a desecration of God's name. What does the word chilul mean? It also means a vacuum. Because we're saying that God isn't here. When we act in a proper way, we're showing God is in this situation. When we don't, we're saying God isn't. This is our purpose. To live that godly life. To learn about Torah. To keep Torah. To practice the commandments. Because every one of them draws and reveals godliness into the world. Okay? So far we have gone through all the different sessions that we've talked about in our outline. In the last session, we will have former Hebrew Christians who are not going to explain to you the philosophical reasons of Christianity and Judaism, but rather share with you some of their experience of how they got pulled into Christianity and how they got out of it. So that will be next week.
Jews for Judaism hopes that you have found this audio recording to be helpful and informative. Jews for Judaism is an international organization dedicated to countering the multi-million-dollar efforts of Christian missionary groups that target Jews, the impact of destructive cults and Eastern religions, and the growing rate of intermarriage that is devastating the Jewish community. Jews for Judaism achieves its goals through one-on-one counseling services and educational programs and materials that connect Jewish people to the spiritual depth, beauty, and wisdom of Judaism. Please contact Jews for Judaism if we can help you. www.jewsforjudaism.ca. Keeping Jews Jewish.